The Fantasy Animation Podcast is a completely independent production. It is made by experts in the field. Chris is a lecturer in liberal arts and visual cultures education at King's College London and author of The Computer Animated Film, available in all good bookshops. And I, Alex that is, am a senior lecturer in film and media studies at the University of Portsmouth and author of Encountering the Impossible, The Fantastic in Hollywood Fantasy Cinema, available in even better bookshops. We do this podcast to provide audiences with an informative and hopefully entertaining guide through the ways in which you can not only enjoy fantasy and animation, but study it, examine it, explore it, and of course, make it and have a career in it. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of the Fantasy Animation Podcast with me, Chris Holliday.
And me, Alex Sargent.
We are back doing, we're doing Disney, but we're doing a belter. I think we're doing an absolute belter of Disney. One of those films that, first animated feature to be nominated for Best Picture Oscar, bombastic musical, film that I realised when I rewatched it, I thought, man, this is absolutely corking. This is 1991. This is Beauty and the Beast. So Gary Truesdale, Gary Truesdale, I should say, past guest on the show. His feature film debut with Kirk Wise, big Broadway musical, right in the kind of the heart of this period that we've come to kind of know as the Disney Renaissance. I think there's lots of stuff we can say about this. We've returned to Disney a few times on the podcast, and sometimes the challenge is I don't really know what else can one say about Disney as a studio, as a corporation. I think there's lots to say about this film just because of its kind of cultural impact. Of course, the fact that it's a musical, and certainly I think from my perspective, yes, I think the Broadway influence is kind of really obviously vital, and we'll talk to our guest about that. But for me also, really interesting use of kind of computer graphics and digital processes and things like that. So I'm really keen to get my proverbial teeth into this. Alex, Beauty and the Beast, fantasy? ?
Yeah, we're in fairy tale town, Chris. This is absolute corker, isn't it? It's hard to know what to say really in terms of what that hasn't already been said. But I'm sure we'll get into fairy tales and various versions of it, and we might mention Jean Cocteau at some point and the kind of lineage of how it fits within fantasy. But excited to do it. And I'm glad we're not doing it alone, because I'm not sure I have much more to say than what has already been said. So, yeah.
No, one of those episodes certainly where we are really thankful to our guest who's come along to kind of make sense of some of the intricacies of the film. So we're delighted to welcome Peter Kuntz, who is assistant professor in the Department of Communication at Tulane University. His research and teaching interests include US media history, media aesthetics, industry studies, convergence culture, and children's media. And he's published a variety of articles and chapters in those areas. And crucially, I think for this podcast, his very recent book, Staging a Comeback, Broadway, Hollywood, and the Disney Renaissance, which came out 2023 by Rutgers University Press, is a text that already sits on my shelf, and it examines the influence of theatrically trained talent on Disney and of Disney on the theatre industry through a revisionist history of the Disney Renaissance. You're going to get on like a house. I can already tell you two are going to get on like a house on fire with your historian's hat on and your revisionist histories. So Peter, thank you ever so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you both.
Yes, well, we're really thrilled to have you. And we were saying before we started recording that obviously this book has just come out, and Beauty and the Beast is on the front cover. So clearly it's an important text, film text, for you as part of your research. So just to kick things off, what is it about Beauty and the Beast? It obviously comes at a really important time, I think, perhaps in Hollywood cinema, animation history more broadly. Specifically about Hollywood and the Hollywood musical, perhaps more, but I've taught it as a musical, I've taught it as an animation. Whereabouts are you coming from? What is it about the film? Why is it such a belter?
Well, there's multiple ways we could argue that it works, right? I think you know, Little Mermaid was kind of underway when Howard Ashman came aboard and kind of worked with a treatment towards making it into a musical. So it's the first of the films he does at Disney where he's there from the very, very beginning. It's also the last film at Disney that he completes in his lifetime, right? Because we know he'd done the work on Aladdin, which goes into rewrite, and Tim Rice comes in. So it has the strongest Ashman influence. It's also quite ironic, right? Because he wasn't actually in Burbank during the production. He's in New York receiving treatment. So it's a bi-coastal production. And seeing how they kind of are navigating Ashman's theatrical intelligence, the technological innovation, Jeffrey Katzenberg's expectations, I think is a real kind of insight into the production culture at Disney during this transitional period. Belle and Beauty and the Beast does for Disney what the company thinks that Dick Tracy is going to do for the company, right? I mean, coming off of Batman at Warner Brothers, right? It's realizing that the franchise fodder is not in comic books or action adventure, but that it's in fairy tale heroines. And I think it reinforces a lesson they start to realize with Ariel, which is that this quote unquote girls audience that, you know, is being neglected actually is more central than they realize. And the importance and the reach of these films for not only girls, but for boys, and also across generations, not just the family audience, but the couples audience. And that was something they started to learn during Little Mermaid. So there's a real reimagining of the production strategy that's starting to take place in the wake of Little Mermaid that builds momentum with Beauty.
So there's loads to unpack there, Pete. And then thanks for that. I think so good job. We've got a bit of a time to do it. I guess let's start, because I know your work wants to highlight the kind of the migration of labor from the kind of theatrical industry or the musical industry into Disney. I'd like to hear more about that. There was a few personalities that you mentioned here that are at play in this piece, and I'm sure listeners who are familiar with the film, and I'm sure they are familiar with the film if they wouldn't be listening to this, are aware of these personalities. But just to kind of, by way of setting the scene, we've got Howard Ashman, who we should talk about, but obviously I suspect there's more of a story beyond Ashman, and Ashman has been spoken about quite a lot. We've got Jeffrey Katzenberger, Michael Eisner, we've got the directors, we've got the writers. So there's lots and lots of sort of big names that are really important within this story. So maybe we could just set the scene as to where we are in sort of what, 1989, 1990, which this film kind of percolates from, and explain who some of these people are.
Sure. The quickest version I think I can give you is has to go back to the early 80s, which is why my book starts in the early 80s, right? So the short version is actually goes back to the 70s, right? Ron Miller is Walt's son-in-law. Roy Disney is Roy Disney's son. After the death of Walt, there's a power struggle for control of the company. Ron Miller, the Walt side of the family, triumphs, right? You know, and then we see throughout the 70s and the 80s, this kind of public discourse around the company as kind of like they lost their creative edge, right? We can challenge that, right? To see some of the innovations that they came through and see, you know, the company moving away from television, the company's investment in theme parks. There is an attempt to do a hostile takeover of the company, right? And by Saul Steinberg. And in the midst of this, Roy Disney resigns from the company and leaves, and then he kind of builds an offensive, right? This effectively pushes out Ron Miller. So now this kind of legion of Walt acolytes, who many had argued were too loyal to the tradition of Walt, are kind of pushed out, right? So Card Walker's gone, Ron Miller's gone, Don Tatum's gone, right? They bring in Michael Eisner from Paramount, and they bring in Frank Wells from Warner Brothers, and then Michael Eisner brings in his right arm assistant, Jeffrey Katzenberg, right, from Paramount. And I argue that this is important because what they bring with them is the high concept strategy, right? So the early effort at the company is going to be, let's focus on live action filmmaking. Let's focus on comedies. Hollywood's not doing them. We can hire these actors who are in a career slump, pay them modestly, and they'll do it for the work. And we'll make these kind of mid-range films and we'll cash in. And they do pretty well in that strategy. Splash was already in production, but films like Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Ruthless People are kind of evocative of that slate, approach to the production slate. They were tempted to either outsource animation or close it entirely. Roy Disney, the guy who engineers them coming in, says you can't do it. Right. And Roy is like, this is the fountain through which the entire company operates. And many of us have seen that famous image from the Walt Disney Company annual report, where there's kind of like, you know, the films are at the center and then you see all these lines going about how everything interacts. Right. Chris Anderson refers to this as total merchandising. Right. But it's what we would now call synergy or transmedia storytelling in this narrative form. Right. So we see the way that Roy explains it, the animated films are the heart that pump blood to the theme parks, the music, the publishing, everything else, right? So Roy's like, you can't close it. So they say, okay, we'll keep it going because you tell us to do it. And they ostensibly put Roy in charge, but Roy doesn't really want to be in charge, right? He wants more of a symbolic role, right? And one of the things I say in the book and others said, who I interviewed said, is like, Roy wanted to be Walt, right? I mean, the way he dressed, the way he groomed himself, he presented himself as kind of in his Uncle Walt vein, but he was not necessarily the storyteller that Walt was, right? At the same time, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who is running production under Michael Eisner, his best friend's David Geffen, the record producer, who also dabbles in theatrical production. And some of his dabbling in theatrical production involves Little Shop of Horrors and Cats. And Geffen has produced a film version of Little Shop of Horrors, and he's been working with the lyricist, book writer. For those who don't know Broadway theater, the book is the parts in the musical where there's talking. So it's the dramatic structure before the songs. So Howard Ashman wrote the lyrics and the book and directed Little Shop of Horrors. He then wrote the screenplay for the film version, which David Geffen produced. David Geffen says to Jeffrey Katzenberg, you need some talent over in the film division. This guy Howard's pretty solid. He's a great guy. Katzenberg calls a meeting with Howard, says, what do you want to do? Right, and basically gives him a list of projects. You can go into television, you can go into live action, you can go into animation. Howard says, I want to go into animation. It's the only place where the musical makes sense, right? And this is kind of key for what I'm arguing in the book, because the type of musical that Howard Ashman wanted to do is not popular on Broadway and is not popular in Hollywood at the time, right? In Hollywood, you get a lot of dance musicals during this period, Footloose, Flashdance, Dirty Dancing. We're not breaking out into song. We are dancing to pop hits, right? And Howard really represents that kind of Rodgers and Hammerstein, Lerner and Lowe tradition that the BMI Musical Theater Workshop was teaching, which was this program that trained musical theater writers in how to do integrated musicals in the tradition of Rodgers and Hammerstein. So Howard comes in with Alan Menken, and they basically say, hey, here's how we learned to do musicals, and here's how they work in animation. So that's a short version, which was very long. Yeah,
it's really interesting because the way that it seems like that this is obviously this film, and I liked what you said about the sort of way in which Disney has retrospectively anchored a lot of some of these transformations within the studio to something like Little Mermaid from 89. And that's certainly, I think, the received narrative around the Disney Renaissance is that it comes, you have that in 89, you have The Simpsons, and you have Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And between all of those three things, something happens where animation is kind of legitimized in some way. But it's interesting that it seems that Beauty and the Beast is influential in terms of Hollywood cinema, Disney animation, and then animation in Hollywood all at once. And it seems like that's the film yeah, that's the film where a lot of these things are kind of crystallizing. I'm trying to think with regards to kind of fantasy, because obviously in the case of something like Beauty and the Beast, it's very easy to say, oh, animation wasn't popular, and then it suddenly was. But where is fantasy in early 90s? I know you've written on Hook, which is the same year, isn't it? But I'm just trying to think around kind of fantasy around late 80s into the 90s, whether the film is influential in Hollywood and on Disney and on animation in Hollywood, what does it do anything of a similar nature for fantasy? I don't know the answer. I'm just I know you've written on Hook, and I was just thinking about that.
I mean, the genre's sort of spending in the 80s trying to court the kind of post Star Wars audience, and by the time Beauty and the Beast comes out, we're sort of at a point where the industry's pretty much given up on that approach, because these films don't make money. You know, your Willows, your the films that I make you watch, Chris, that you go, sure, what on earth is this? Those films that are now quite beloved by certain sections but don't make money at the time. And Hook's the last death now. And I think what one of the other legacies of Beauty and the Beast and these collection is it repackages fantasy storytelling in a much more profitable and family friendly way. And that's kind of what happens throughout the 90s, right? Is that we don't get these kind of blockbuster fantasies, as I might call them, but you get these kind of, you know, I'm hesitant to use the word retreat, because that implies that like where you really want to be is live action, which is of course not what we're here to do. But it there's this sense that it that's where it goes into these kind of animation stories, and one of the things that always strikes me about, actually less so with Beauty and the Beast, because I think it's so interested in its musical form, but the story and the world, well, it is embellished, but it's embellished largely from well, I think Pete, you'll know more about this than I do, but I know obviously there's the whole link with the Jean Cocteau 1946 Beauty and the Beast, La Belle et la Bête, and the way it kind of uses that, but it's really kind of using that as a template just to do what you're talking about, kind of let's make a really kind of Rodgers and Hammerstein-esque musical. But the other ones, the kind of the Aladdins, the Little Mermaids, these are kind of really quite rich, textured fantasy worlds that these people are creating. That, you know, a Snow White, a Sleeping Beauty, the films that they're supposedly rebirthing, that they just don't have. There are fairy tale films and there are fantasy films, and I guess Beauty and the Beast is kind of liminal and all that. So it's a really fascinating one to watch as a fantasy historian, because it feels simpler. Not in a bad way. It feels more folkloric. It feels more archetypal. I'm struck by the opening shot of the movie, where it's kind of like, it's kind of recalling the kind of multiplane camera, right, of old. And the image is both deep and shallow, because it's both flat and wide. And there's a certain quality to that, to the fantasy storytelling, in the world is both flatter and wider than some of these other kind of textured fantasies. Yeah, I mean, on that subject of rebirth, the one question out of that explanation, Pete, that I wanted to ask was like, so why a musical? Why was it like, okay, what we need is some massive musical talent to come here and shake things up? Is there something going on in the mid-80s around, is that the only industry that's still working? Like, what's going on that people think, okay, what we need is to re-embrace, is it about re-embracing the musical? Is it about... You know, why is that the assumption people make, that the way that we can save the animation department, or the way we can at least get the animation part going again, is to bring in talent from Broadway and Chicago and other musical circuits? Because that doesn't seem intuitive to me as a solution.
Well, I think it's the other way around, right? It's I don't think they were looking for a musical person. I think Katzenberg was kind of in a hiring spree, right? And he was interested in hiring talent who would work at an affordable rate. So he ends up getting a lot of people who are in a career slump. Richard Dreyfuss, Bette Midler. I mean, as Bette Midler admits in the press at the time, my career's in the toilet. Of course I'll you know, take a lower rate. And then, you know, theater people and Hollywood big shots, right? The Katzenberg memo famously kind of outlines that strategy, right? They said, we got egg on our face when we hired the guy who wanted a lot of money. So I think what it came down to is, you know, his best friend told him this guy's really smart. And Howard was trained in the theater, was a director and a writer. He knew how a story had to be structured. And this is where Disney keeps getting hit by the critics, right? It's like, this story doesn't make sense, right? It's too episodic. It's too loose. I don't care about the characters, right? And basically, Howard Ashman's a storyteller that they're like, hey, you know how stories work. What do you want to do? And the memo that Katzenberg details what he can work on, you know, he can do a Mary Poppins sequel. He can do, you know, this film about a talk show host that eventually becomes a Dolly Parton vehicle called Straight Talk. He opts for the musical, in part because he has this kind of dramatic intelligence and he sees the possibilities. And he thinks that animation is the only place where it can still work, right? The idea of Ariel going to her grotto and breaking out into a song works in animation in a way that it would not have worked if, you know, Julia Roberts had broken out into a song at that time, by his assessment. So I think that he goes to animation as a fan. And looking back over his career, he'd always had this kind of interest in fairy tales, too.
So I think we've answered, is it a musical and why is it a musical, at least as thoroughly as we can. Should we think about how it's a musical? Because it's such a, you know, we haven't sort of delved into the textual specifics of it, but as you were talking about there, Pete, it's full. If you've never seen it, you have, because it's full of moments that have kind of echoed throughout pop culture. And if you have seen it, rewatching it is kind of this, well, I find it quite a kind of surreal exercise of kind of jumping from one memorable moment to the next with little moments you forget in between, right? Or little eccentricities. So if we kind of try and work our way through the movie, I was struck in the opening. So the opening obviously fits exactly what you're saying. It's this kind of, it's the fanfare number. We get the kind of stained glass window prologue, which functions as a kind of storybook open in the kind of classic Disney sense.
Yep.
Anyway, we then get the opening number. We get the fanfare. We get the opening, you know, Belle recently reimagined in the kind of live action version of it. And we get this kind of opening number that announces our world, our story. I, this time watching it, couldn't help think about the film that this was going to be before the musical.
Mm.
From my understanding, it was going to be an extremely historicized kind of piece. It was going to be sort of tried to be set within, you know, make more of its Frenchness, make more of its kind of its world. And I suspect some of the visual art survives from that, but I'm just assuming that. Again, Pete, I'm sure you'll know more. To me, the song this time sort of made me think very much this is a song sung by people who have left their hometowns to become creatives, making a musical that very much disdains against small town prejudices and small town ambitions. Because basically, there's about, what, 45 seconds on screen of people being nice to Belle. There's the baker says hello. The bookshop owner seems to quite like her. And then after that, the townspeople are nothing but risible throughout the entire movie. So yeah, I guess we could start by talking about the kind of the setting of this kind of small town, nominally France, but sort of not really. What do we have thoughts on?
You know, the prologue music is interesting too, right? Because it comes from Carnival of the Animals, Camille Saint-Saëns.
Oh, right, okay.
And it was actually a placeholder, and then Katzenberg wouldn't let Menken remove it, so they actually had to kind of do a little bit more flourish on it. The age of the Beast was actually a major point of contention. I believe Howard Ashman wanted the Beast to be much younger, but then Gary Truesdale and Kirk Wise and others were like, no, that makes it tragic that this young kid is struck down for, you know, vanity. And the politics of whose film this is, in terms of Belle or the Beast, is an interesting one. The more I read in the archive, the more I think Howard identified with the Beast over Belle, although I think there's a tendency for fans to be like, oh, Belle wants to get out, just like Howard wanted to get out. I mean, Howard came from suburban Baltimore, and I talked to a lot of people who grew up with him there, and you know, it sounds like he had a really wonderful existence of being a theater artist. I'm not sure that right. This kind of psychobiography is a useful analytical tool, especially in animation, which is such a collaborative art form. In terms of Belle, right, that song is actually based on And this is an engine. I'm going to say this a lot. Based on. One of Alan Menken's part of his genius, right? It's also the genius of someone like Stephen Sondheim, is pastiche, right? Knowing that they need to write a number like, or a number in the spirit of, right? And you know, much like filmmakers in live action cinema that are citational and intertextual. Musical theater artists and animators are very intertextual, right? You know, that moment during Belle's Reprise where she comes up through the field is so clearly lifted from The Sound of Music. And the opening number of Beauty and the Beast is lifted from a show called She Loves Me, which is a 1960s Broadway musical, probably more popular here in the US than the UK. I'm not sure how well it's traveled, but it's based on The Shop Around the Corner, the Lubitsch film. So that kind of like bouncy, like good morning, good day, right? Like that's taken pretty clearly from there, right? And then Belle's aspirational qualities, and you know, there's several memes I've seen circulate over the years of people saying like the people are like, good morning, Belle, and she's just like, you know, hey, Rube. So yeah, this kind of a class element here. I think it's a bouncy song. I think it's one of the best melodies Menken ever wrote. But yeah, there is an interesting kind of sense of like they're nice to her, but also she's not nice back. And I would say in Belle's defense, to the degree that she needs defending at all, I mean, there is a certain degree of Philistinism she encounters in that walk, right? Like she's trying to tell them about things and they're kind of like, yeah, whatever, right? Or, you know, and they treat her as strange, right? And I think that that's kind of enabled certain readings of Belle as kind of, you know, a queered figure, right? One who's kind of pushed to the outside or the margins. Or so I would say there's perhaps a little bit of gesturing towards the fact that there's a bit of, you know, we're nice to her, but she's an odd one versus, you know, I'm nice to them, but they're provincial.
Yeah. And this is going back to, I guess, thinking about Belle and going back to some of the things that you were saying around the distinction between the people that are familiar with musicals will know between integrated and then kind of Broadway. This is, and you mentioned the star voices before, and we've had conversations on the podcast about this myth around the Disney Renaissance and star voices, and Alex has talked about kind of the history of star voices in animation and how people were well known well back to the Jungle Book and before and stuff. So this is, I always get my Paige O'Hara's and my Jodie Benson's mixed up, but this is Paige O'Hara, and she is a Broadway performer. So this is, and Robbie Benson as well, who's in the film, Angela Lansbury. These are kind of well-known, sort of familiar, and you mentioned Oliver and Company as well before, mm-hmm. and how, and what I find really interesting about what you were saying is how you can think through the music to actually unhomogenize the Disney Renaissance as this period of Disney history, and actually think about, because one of the things we haven't talked about is the fact that The Rescuers Down Under is between 1989 and 1991, but we don't really count that in the Disney Renaissance because it doesn't quite do the things that we think the Renaissance should do. But anyway, mm-hmm. but I like the idea that music kind of unravels some of the ways in which we might think of the Renaissance as actually quite varied in some of the things that it's doing, and certainly this label of the Broadway musical is often embodied through spectacle, and obviously in the case of a lot of the films that we're kind of dealing with, I think the way that these animated films use then digital effects to enhance the spectacle. But this opening number, is it fair to say that it's sort of exploiting the kind of Broadway aesthetic in a particular way? The fact that you have Paige O'Hara singing this particular song, the way that it, because I don't know, there seems to be, when we talk about the Broadway musical, there are lots of different ways that you could understand that term. And I remember listening to some scholar, I think it was Susan Smith actually writes about the animated musical, talking about how a lot of the musical numbers in these Disney films, there's a pause at the end of the musical numbers before dialogue starts up again, almost as if you are imagining an audience applauding, and then the action starts up again. So they build in these moments of sort of silence so that the audience can kind of catch their breath. But to me, yeah, Belle is an interesting, I mean, I think I like the opening number. I think symbolically it's quite interesting because it taps into, I think there's a broader issue of the way that technology is used in these Disney Renaissance films, that CGI is something there that wasn't there before. in these movies. And I like the way the outsiderdom of Bell and the way that scholars have kind of written about digital technologies being introduced through these films in particular ways, not through the action sequences, I'd argue, actually through the musical numbers. So I really like Bell, but this is, going back to what I was saying, this is Paige O'Hara, this is a good example of where, or do you think, Pete, this is a good example of the Broadway musical, like Disney doing it and doing it kind of properly? Like this is where, when we say Broadway musical, we mean these kinds of numbers.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that it's the particularly the integrated musical tradition on Broadway, right? I mean, I think my colleagues who do Broadway history would say, but what about the history of the revue? And what about the history of the jukebox musical? And what about, you know, what we might call the mega musical tradition? And Jessica Sternfeld has written a beautiful book about that. And that reminds me too, you know, what you're saying about Paige O'Hara. You know, one of the things I love about working on Disney is, you know, at the end of the Power Rangers, where they all had to kind of come together to beat the bad guy. I mean, I think one of the issues I had when I was pitching this book is one of the presses I took it to sent it to a musicologist, and the musicologist would say, "This isn't musicology," and I said, "You're right, it's not trying to be, right?" Yeah. But I've done the work in the archive that no one else has done yet, and let musicology come in and do their thing, right? And so what you're saying about Paige O'Hara, I mean, I think this is where someone like Jennifer Flieger's work, and Jennifer Flieger also comes from film studies, right? But you know, has a really strong understanding of film sound and film music, right? Where she reminds us that, like, this is when the Disney princess is a Broadway performer, right? It's a certain style of singing. It's a certain style of musical composition that is quite distinct from what we see with Snow White and Cinderella, and is going to change quite a bit when we get to Tangled and Mandy Moore comes in, right? But I said, like, you know, you can't just hire, you know, a Julia Roberts or Demi Moore, right? Although, of course, Demi Moore is in Hunchback. You know, you have to hire, you know, someone who can do this, right? And he really liked Paige O'Hara's work on... there was a production of the show Showboat, which is interesting because Showboat in the history of musical theater is often treated as the first show where, like, musicals can do a dramatic story seriously and can integrate in the narrative. But she in that she performs kind of as the her part is kind of an actress who's a bit kind of cheeky and you know, and capitalizes on that kind of period in time in which actresses were seen as socially disreputable young women, but you know that character of Ellie is kind of a more of a fun character, and then obviously she comes in here and she's friends with Jodie Benson, and Jodie Benson tells her, you know, you've got to sing it, you've got to bring it in. And that was one of the issues Jodie Benson had, right? Is like she gets in front of that microphone to record for the voice, and you know, her Broadway belt comes out, so all of a sudden she's singing for the back row, and Howard actually had to help her restrain it. But I mean, you know, the vocal performance and scholars who are working on that question, I think, are doing some really important work for helping us to understand not just the technology, which you're doing, which is very important and which I don't understand, right? Or, you know, the dramatic stuff that's happening narratologically that I try to bring to the conversation. But I mean, like, the sound of the Disney Renaissance is a crucial area of intervention here. And then the other thing, going back to, you know, I think about the end of Under the Sea or the end of Be Our Guest, where literally they hold for applause, right? In dramaturgically speaking, those are show-stopping numbers, right? And the function of a show-stopping number is get every actor out on stage and have them sing into this large, spirited song. And then, you know, if you've done your job, the audience is kind of catching their breath, right? So there is that kind of beat, right? And it reflects, you know, what Jane Feher talks about, right, in her foundational work on the musical, right? Which is that, you know, unlike other genres that moved from the stage to film, the musical never really lost its presentational manner, right? So, you know, we talk about Godard and other filmmakers in the 60s who got very meta with film and had actors address the audience and things like that. But that's always been the case in the musical, right? Gene Kelly looks in the camera, Ann Miller looks in the camera. And that's what we see happening in Be Our Guest and Under the Sea, right? The initial cover of my book was from The Chandelier, when the chandelier is in Busy. So I switched to, you know, when Lumiere is dancing on the cakes, because it gave me a very Bob Fosse vibe. But in both of the images that were going to be on the cover, right, I wanted that image because that is the moment where we're reminded the musical is a creation of the stage that has been adapted for the camera. And that idea of the fourth wall being breakable in the musical and that kind of artifice being allowed works in animation in a way that, for some reason or another, right, we could hypothesize the structure of feeling of the 80s, you know, people were just kind of increasingly cringing over. And that becomes more relevant even today when we think about musicals like The Color Purple and Mean Girls being marketed not as musicals, even though they are absolutely in that tradition of we're going to break out into song, right?
Mm. Well, that kind of reflexivity that you said, that presentational manner, that just describes the history of animation. Animation mm-hmm. was adapted from the stage to the screen. There are books, there are people writing like Malcolm Cook that talk about that presentational history. And we've done episodes on the Lightning Sketch and that sort of those vaudeville traditions that informed the shape and the look and the kind of stylistic repertoire of early animated cartoons. So that's another reason. I mean, many scholars have written about why animation is so good to think about music, and certainly in the case of the Disney studio, you have these two moments. You have the Mickey Mousing and Synchrony in the 20s and 30s, and you have the Disney Renaissance and the Broadway musical, and these are the two moments. Just to go back to Jennifer Flieger, so one of the interesting things about her work, and again, kind of mapping quite homogenous ways of thinking about Disney through sound, and actually breaking up, as you say, these discrete periods, what happens when certain kinds of voices are used at particular moments. One of her interesting points is that for me, is that she implicates technology into a discussion of mm-hmm. the voice, mm-hmm. but in a way that's quite, and I mean this in a really, really, really positive way, but kind of dismissive and assumed. So she says, and this is a quote, the operatic voice, CAPS, which is the computer program that was used to sort of organize space and character movement, and the increasing use of computer-aided effects were justified as essential to a good show by the Broadway voice. So I thought that was really interesting because it aligns together the Broadway voice as she defines it and thinks about it through figures like Benson and O'Hara, and then implicates technology into that as a sort of, and it's this really interesting therefore meeting point at various moments in the film that bring those two things together. Alex, you're looking at me.
Well, I hate to become a cliche of myself, but we also need to throw in the fantastical into this, right? Which is
we do.
What these things also look like. That ending, that moment of Be Our Guest, where they kind of pause on screen and go like ta-da, mm-hmm. also looks like a kind of the tableaus that like Méliès would end his movies mm-hmm. With, like, you know, Kingdom of the Fairies. They do this kind of big tableau at the end of all these movies, which goes back to traditions of 19th century French visual entrancements, the fairy, which kind of migrated over to the US from London into things. So there's that presentational form there as well, right? And the film is at its most spectacular, fantastical, and musical all in the same moments of the movie, right? The Be Our Guest number is to showcase this kind of technological marvelous of all these different contraptions moving about. The chandelier sequence is to highlight dance. It's to highlight the depth achieved through the technology, and also the kind of the fantastical body of this beast contorting and moving around as mm-hmm. if, well, as man and things like that. So it's all, I guess I just knew that those are the things I'm supposed to say on the podcast at this point. So I felt the need to say it, but they're all kind of part of this kind of presentational address where the movie really pops.
Yeah.
And it really, like, I mean, Be Our Guest, we've talked about, but that the chandelier sequence, that is such a it's such a rich moment that I can't really do justice to, but let's talk more about that. Pete, tell us some stuff about the chandelier sequence. There must be a memo you found in an archive somewhere that we can help where they say get rid of it, drag in the story or something yeah. like that. Give us it.
Yeah. I'll say this.
There's computers everywhere. Yeah.
You know, I want to preface my comment because I love podcasts as an open forum because you can speak extemporaneously, and I've abused that interminably in this instance. But one of the things I love about this conversation we're having, right, is you know, I talk to graduate students or early career folks, and they get this kind of like this anxiety over writing about films and covering everything. And And I think it's so important for us to remind our students and our younger scholars, like, you're not writing the last word on this, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like what our conversation has just demonstrated is what someone who brings a knowledge of technology, someone who brings a knowledge of fantasy, someone who tries to bring a knowledge of theater and of drama, like, we all have something to add to this, right? You're not writing the last word on Beauty and the Beast, you're writing the next word on Beauty and the Beast. So that part I just want to highlight is, like, it's great to be able to sit with you two and hear what you see in that moment, because it also inspires me to say, when you call it the chandelier scene, I mean, I think of it as the Shall We Dance scene, right? Because
sure,
that is the moment where the influence of The King and I smacks you over the face for someone like me, who is a theater kid at heart, right? For those of you who haven't seen The King and I, right, he basically is trying to convince the British envoy that he's not a savage, right? There's this awful Orientalist politic at the heart of The King and I, which is evocative of mid-century, pro-American century, kind of like, we're going to save the world. And Miss Anna, as many feminist scholars have noted, is essentially a proxy for Queen Victoria, kind of bringing civility, and him wanting that kind of modernization for Siam. And then Shall We Dance is, he has just given this large party for the British envoy and shown that Siam is actually a modern, forward-thinking country. And so they go back and they're kind of patting themselves on the back about it. And, he basically says, I saw you dancing with, the others, and that's not the way you dance with me, right? And then they break into this, some people have called it a waltz, including me in earlier work, and I was promptly corrected by our colleagues in dance and music. We're like, no, the Shall We Dance is a polka. Notice how kind of forceful it is, right? And of course, part of The King is that he has this kind of, again, racist, Orientalist kind of bestial quality, right? There's this aggressive machismo to him that she's softening with her Western English gentility. That moment for me, the quote unquote chandelier scene, is a moment of in genre theory terms, a moment of domestication and embrace, right? Like, this is the moment where her kind of hostility towards him, and rightly so, he has imprisoned her. She starts to really kind of see him for who he can be. And he, on the other hand, has kind of softened his rage, right? And there's an old corny saying that dance is the vertical expression of horizontal desire. And much like in Rodgers and Hammerstein, as in Disney animation, you can't have a sex scene, right? And when I teach The King and I to my students, we notice that there's that moment where the king puts his hand on her midsection to dance with her, and she kind of gasps, right? And that was in Hammerstein's original script. But that's about as provocative as it gets. And they remove the gasp in Beauty and the Beast, right? But it's serving the same function, right? A consummation of their romance and them kind of meeting in the middle, right? In terms of the technology, right, there is some stuff I quote in the book and in coming out of memos and whatnot, where basically there's a kind of a thinking that I believe Katzenberg has, right? Where it's like, if the characters aren't moving, then the camera needs to be moving, which is why we end up with this kind of grandiose flourish, away from the characters up into the chandelier and, the ceiling that has those kinds of, is it Botticelli who did the famous kind of cherubs, right?
Cherubs,
Yeah. And then, but I love that moment too, because, you kind of see something that Howard wanted people to see. And talking to his family, they were very, one of the things I appreciated about it was they really wanted me to move away from the idea that Howard saved Disney, right? Because that narrative, I mean, I already thought this as a historian, but it was great to hear them say it, right? But the Disney Renaissance for me is theater people, Maureen Donnelly, who was an executive during this period, said it was an unholy marriage between animation and theater. And one of the questions I kept coming back to is, like, how does an animator listen to a musical theater guy about how to tell a story, right? And at the heart of it, and I asked animators outright, I'm like, why the hell would you listen to this New York guy? And they said he loved it. He loved what we did. He loved our art, our craft. He knew our history. And, you know, we knew we were committed to telling a better story. And I think that that's one of the things I love about that moment is it reminds us that animators, as not only artists, but as, you know, innovators and technician, right? And kind of how that kind of creates something bigger than Howard on his own could have created, right? And Gary says this, Gary Truesdale, who directed Beauty and the Beast, remember earlier when I said the repertory thing, was a story artist on Little Mermaid. So a hell of a promotion. And he storyboarded Le Poisson, right? And I said, you know, what was it like being an animator to get like Howard's lyrics for Le Poisson? And like, did you feel like he was kind of, and he's like, no, I loved it. He told me exactly what to do. But, you know, in that song, which for some of us is kind of like, why is this here? Right. And Gary says, oh, no, you need that song there because not only is it the comedy song that so many musicals have. Right. I mean, you know, the Music Man was on Broadway 2 years ago and a lot of people were groaning because they're like, oh, Shapoopy. Right. But it's like, no, you need that kind of like lighthearted song. And Gary made a great point where he's like, Le Poisson reminds us that the world that enchants Ariel terrifies Sebastian, right? And he said, and then to get the lyrics from Howard, it was almost like he was kind of providing me directions on what I could do, but also giving me space to do all those things, right? So that sequence, which narratively we may be like, oh, this doesn't work. It really is a moment where an animator gets to show off what they can do. And animation, of course, as a form, allows for a degree of fantasy and experimentation, right? So I've moved away from the chandelier scene. But
no.
Yeah. Get me back on track. I mean, what about the chandelier scene do we want to see?
Well,
but I mean, I think that the technological innovation there, but also the agency of animators in the storytelling, right? And I think that for all the love of Howard Ashman that's out there, and rightly so, it risks erasing the fact that he was far from the only hand involved in this film. And because of his health, you know, Linda Wolverton told me when I interviewed her, she's like, I think he wanted to write it himself. He just couldn't because of his treatment for HIV/AIDS, right? So I think that's one of those moments where we have to remind ourselves that, like, there are multiple expertises here, multiple artists at work, and look what they accomplished when they came together.
Yeah. It's funny that you call it the chandelier scene and the shall we dance scene. I call it the digital ballroom scene.
right, exactly.
Because I'd done a bit of research, thinking about the use of, I think the way that digital technology is often integrated or has been understood to be integrated into the Disney Renaissance is through these action sequences or scenes that are driven by kind of action and sort of movement. So thinking about, I suppose, the Magic Carpet and Aladdin would be a good example, or the Wildebeest Stampede. And some of the things that I've been kind of looking at were the way that they were, where the musical numbers were themselves really important test cases for playing with this sort of quote-unquote new technology. It was out there from Hunchback of Notre Dame. It's the deep canvas work in Tarzan. Yes, it's important to the action sequences, but it's also really important. Like, it's the musical numbers that are making a spectacle out of this technology. And so Don Hahn talks about the digital ballroom in a way that you can absolutely imagine. This is exactly how digital technology is talked about in terms of like freedom and exaggeration and stuff. He says, we did this with computer graphics techniques, building a set digitally and flying the camera around. And the CGI supervisor, Jim Hillen, says that the use of computer-generated color backgrounds via RenderMan, so the software in the sequence, would basically give the illusion of a sweeping camera moves and perspectives, as well as theatrical lighting that would otherwise be impossible. So this is a kind of common refrain, I think, in the way that you sell digital technology in terms of kind of creativity and movement and excessive kind of flexibility and so forth. But it is the film's kind of signature CG sequence. It's also interesting that 1991 is also the year, given the mention of RenderMan, which is Pixar's proprietary software, that 1991 is the year that Pixar signed the deal with Disney to produce a feature-length computer animated film. So you could also read some of these musical sequences in the same way you can read Pixar's advertisements of the period, Pixar's short films of the period. These are all, in some way or another, kind of test cases for playing with certain kinds of technology. Because certainly I think the way, and we've mentioned Michelle Pearson on the podcast before, her designation of this Wonder Years period, which is interestingly it brackets the first part of the Disney Renaissance between 89, she says, and 95. This is the wonder years of exploration of digital technology in Hollywood. And I think Disney have got their own wonder years running parallel to that because they've got this kind of, you can really easily plot the way in which digital technology is being used. As I said, yes, it's being used for wildebeest stampedes and the kind of the realization of Hydra and Hercules, or some of the action sequences and Pocahontas, but really it's being used in the musical numbers. And so I've always been interested that Disney, when I've taught Disney animation and kind of Disney technology and actually and Hollywood cinema, that you have this Wonder Years period that many scholars like Michelle Pearson and I think even Lisa Peirce extends it to like 89 to 99, I think, which is obviously the end of the Renaissance. But the Wonder Years period of exploration of digital technology in Hollywood, Disney's very much part of it. And you can almost plot a similar narrative of digital, I don't want to say digital chaos, but I mean in a kind of chaotic exploration of what this technology can do. It sort of runs parallel to this live action history. Disney have got their own Wonder Years going on, which I kind of like. Yeah, but for me, it's all about the digital ballroom, guys. All about the digital ballroom.
We're vastly running out of time here, and there's so much more to be said.
There really is.
So I'm just thinking of what has to be said or what we'll get really annoyed about or more importantly, what our listeners will get really more annoyed about if we
I've got one.
All right.
For Pete. Yeah, no, it's about the different versions of the film because I watched the film on Disney Plus and I was disappointed not to see Human again. This kind of amazing musical number, one of my favourites that isn't in. So from my understanding of this film, the kind of Broadway, there are numbers in this film there are different versions of this film. The film has been reimagined. We talked at the beginning about kind of revisionist histories, thinking about the kind of implication, the cultural influence of this film, industrial influence of this film, aesthetic influence of this film. It seems like there are different versions of it that show that they're, again, I think that bear out some of your points about the industry and these different creative voices and expertise, that there are, of course, missing musical numbers that I think only really adds to the mythology around this film. That wasn't a question, that was just a statement.
Yeah, no, I was like, was that a question, Alex?
No,
I mean, you're right. I thought you were going to talk about the Purnums, but we already covered that too, right? I guess part of it for me, since so much of this is a kind of a Howard-focused entree into this, right? Because one thing that should be said is I imagine many of your listeners know, is it's hard as hell to do Disney history. They don't want us in there. In part because they want to control the narrative, and in part because they have they make a lot of money writing the history themselves, right? Like there are a lot of Disney sanctioned histories, and that's not to say that the people who write those aren't doing good work. On the one hand, Howard was my way in because his papers are publicly available in the U.S. Beyond the control of Disney, and on the other hand, he's only one figure, right? Human Again, and getting to see, the songs he wanted in there, and how they would have fit. And, the thing with Human Again and how it ends up in the later DVD is that it wasn't until Disney went to Broadway that Alan Menken figured out how to make Human Again work in the narrative, right? So it wasn't it was an integration issue in terms of why it didn't end up in the film to begin with. And then when he figured out how to use it for the Broadway show, they then retroactively added it into maybe the 10th anniversary version. Do you have the correct when that came
like
in?
That. No. But that seems that sort of act is seemingly symbolic of all the things that you were talking about, the sort of reciprocal relationship between these different and the flow of personnel between different I don't want to say media platform, but different ways of presenting stories. And so that seems really symbolic of that you have something that doesn't work in an animated film. You have a film that is influenced by Broadway, not being able to make something work, that then it gives it back to Broadway to make it work and then takes it back again for the DVD release.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, right? But it's also the same artist, right? I mean, it's Alan Menken. And he and Linda talked about, you know, like, oh my God, they wanted to put it on the stage. Yikes. But then, you know, when they got in there and they were given a kind of a little bit of a license to play and flesh it out, right? Because the other thing that has to be mentioned too is an animated film at Disney is what, 80 minutes, maybe 90 minutes long. And then a Broadway musical very rarely goes shorter than 2 hours and 20 minutes, right? So they had a lot more time. And they could develop those characters and they could bring in those songs, right? And the same thing happens when Aladdin goes to Broadway, right? Songs that had been cut out, like Proud of Your Boy, which was one of Ashman's favorite songs, comes back in, right? In part as a tribute to Howard. And that's kind of one of the poignant moments of the Renaissance and these stories is, you know, if Howard had been healthy and had been able to be present in a way he would have liked to have been present, what would Aladdin have looked like? What would Beauty and the Beast have looked like? And that being said, he also made many concessions that he knew he had to make, right? Like there are things he didn't want, but it was like, yeah, that's how it has to happen in order for the story to work, right? And that's one of the things I think that theater makers do really well is that they understand that like we're in service of something bigger than ourselves, and if the story needs it, the story needs it. Right. But, you know, the character of Aladdin's mother was kind of a post Ashman casualty. I was just going to briefly say, and I think I should gesture this in the book, but I don't know if he would have let, you know, we've heard all this kind of fanfare about, you know, Robin Williams and his genius for improvisation. I wonder if he would have gotten away with that if Ashman had been there. Because we know that Ashman was behind the firing of someone like Elaine Stritch for doing the voice of Ursula, in part because Elaine Stritch was notorious for going off book and, you know, riffing. And she didn't take direction well, right? But, you know, she got away with that on Broadway, where she was a bankable personality. At that time, she certainly wasn't a bankable personality in film, and certainly not a Disney film, where, you know, there's often these kind of guardrails very much in place. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I think this is... I've just really... I think there's a version of this podcast where we sort of go through the film beat by beat and sort of think about its relationship to animation and fantasy, which is would not be unpleasant, but this kind of industrial back history to the film that really makes you think totally differently about how it began and the creative process and how it then what it then looks like on screen and why those two things, like the production of the film, the pre-production, the people that are involved in the film, it's more than just the film that's part of the Disney Renaissance. That there seems to be a lot more going on that is really kind of intriguing, I think, that I didn't know and kind of didn't think about. And as you say, that's part of the challenge of doing Disney history, because, and I know that, yeah, Alex always describes himself as a lapsed historian, but Disney is this curious intellectual object that sometimes scholarship, we don't really know what to do with Disney and how we talk about it. And as you say, they often curate a version of their own history that becomes the official version. And so being able to look at some of these papers that you've done and build this, kind of incredible industrial history of the Disney Renaissance is, thank goodness we got you on.
Tease us, Pete, with some other highlights from the book. We've kind of focused on Beauty and the Beast today with a bit of, you know, backstory behind it. If listeners wanted to... go out and purchase a copy, what else would they be able to look forward to?
Yeah. So the shortest version, which you know is a lie already because you know I'm going to go on too long, is, you know, the short version is the Disney Renaissance began in 1989 and ended in 1999, right? This is a version we see kind of rehearsed, and that I never actually saw anyone do the work of tracing it and seeing if that's really the case. So the book begins with the idea of in 1982... And I pull a little bit of a trick there where I say, like, listen, I'm not saying the Disney Renaissance began in 1982. I'm just saying it didn't begin in 1989. And if we look at what's happening in Broadway and Hollywood contextually, we can kind of see the foundations being, you know, laid out for what's going to come later, right? So Chris's brilliant survey of technological innovation in animation, right? I mean, I'm sure you could have gone on for another 20, 30 minutes about, you know, Black Cauldron and Great Mouse Detective.
Right.
The Big Ben sequence is brilliant. But, you know, and that often gets erased when we look at, like, you know, this moment of transcendence, right? But like, you know, Disney, beginning with arguably Tron and maybe Black Hole, depending on how you're feeling in a certain day. I mean, you know, the kind of the special effects, visual effects innovations it's making are kind of laying the groundwork. So that chapter 1982 is strategically chosen because I wanted to have a non-Disney animator, right? Don Bluth's The Secret of Nim, his first independently produced film after he departs from Disney in 79. Disney releases Tron, which retroactively has found a fandom, right? But of course was a huge failure at the time, but innovatively is an incredibly important film. And yet Disney is rewriting that history as if Tron is always, like, I bought the DVD of Tron a few years ago and it says the original classic. And I'm like, you should put an asterisk on this. and then it's also the year of Howard Ashman's Little Shop of Horrors downtown in New York, in what's called the off-Broadway scene. And for those who don't know, off-Broadway is not about location. It's about size of the venue, right? So if the theater has between 100 and 500 seats, it's an off-Broadway theater, right? Oh. So Little Shop of Horror was designed to go into an off-Broadway theater. He did not design that as a Broadway musical, him and Alan. And at the same time, and indeed many of the same producers that are involved in the creation of this small integrated musical are also helping to bring in this very large, very spectacular, not very integrated musical called Cats, right? And so that's kind of mapping out the context. And then the next chapter is kind of like, you know, rethinking the turnover from Michael Eisner, from Ron Miller to Michael Eisner, and complicating that history as if Michael Eisner saved the company, and arguing that A, Ron Miller actually did do a lot of things that laid the groundwork for Disney's future success, although he may not have had the vision ultimately, and B, showing that Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg's initial strategies were not in fact successful, right? Because they get there in 84 and the quote unquote Renaissance doesn't start to 89. So what the hell were they doing for 5 years? and then there's a chapter on Mermaid as a way into Disney in 1989 and 90. Disney in 88, 89, and then looking using Mermaid to look at 90, 91, including Rescuers Down Under, which has been tragically ignored and is an incredibly important film for a variety of reasons. Going into after Beauty, kind of doing a pivot, right? Because that's when Disney starts to look towards Broadway. But it's also when the musical changes, right? The Lion King is not the Broadway-style musical to the same... is not as has admitted this as Beauty is, right? And then by the time you get to Tarzan, the music is extra, you know, is non-diegetic, right? So we see shifting experimentations with what a Disney musical means in those films. So then Beauty and the Beast is important because it's the first film to go to stage, but it's also a critical failure and a commercial smash. And then of course Lion King shows up. And that's Disney's second attempt, gets the critical attention and the commercial attention, right? But it's also not an integrated musical in the purest sense of the term, right? Trying to appreciate the various forms of the musical and its role in Disney's kind of turnaround and the artists behind that, and thinking about how they're helping to... redirect corporate strategy and getting people to realize in a very industry studies way that a creative decision is a business decision in the same way that business decisions shape creative decisions, right? We don't use the word determine, we use the word shape, thinking in that kind of loop that emerges. And then the conclusion kind of says, you know, where are we at today with Disney and musicals, right? And stronger than ever in some ways, right? When we think about things like Frozen and Encanto and, the role of the influence of Disney on Broadway. And I need to put an asterisk on that, because when people say, oh, you work on Disney on Broadway, like, well, you know, why does that matter? It matters because Disney on Broadway is the foundation through which we see, particularly in the United States, but I imagine throughout Europe and the rest of the world, right? Children putting on Disney shows in community centers, at schools, at churches, and touring productions, which generate an incredible amount of revenue. So an argument's been made that the most successful popular culture object ever created in terms of the money it's generated is The Lion King on Broadway, which has made over $10 billion. in its various incarnations, right? So, like, that's not small potatoes, although scholars of the Walt Disney Company often mention the theater venture in, you know, a couple paragraphs and then kind of move on. So that's kind of the book.
Buy the book. Buy the book, folks.
So buy the book.
get your library to buy it at least, so I get my, you know, 50 cents of royalty and can buy half a cup of coffee.
Yeah. Great. Well, no, absolutely going to get both counts, actually. Really. No, it's been a pleasure, Pete. And really, I learned a lot, which is and I'm sure people listening learn a lot and will be rushing out to get the book in all the different formats that it exists. Really great work, because it's such an important kind of moment in pop cultural history, and it's great to sort of see the hard work of the archive, the memos, the labor exchange being part of that story and being made front and center, because it can be so easy to tell this story kind of through the lens we've been given by Disney and the lens we kind of almost want to take as fans and things. So it's a great project to talk you through, and thanks for joining us to do this. Right, I guess the rose petals wilted, so we should probably call that a day. You can of course find other episodes where we talk about other Disney classics, and Chris has mentioned at the top there's one where we talk to Gary Truesdell about Atlantis, the Lost Empire.
Yes.
So check that one out. You can find that on our website, fantasy-animation.org, but also through the various places you get your podcast. You can send us an email if you have a suggestion for a future footnote at fananimresearch@gmail.com. I'm happy to take all your suggestions and look forward to doing them in the future. You can use that same handle, fananimresearch, fananimresearch, on all our social media handles to talk to us there. Otherwise, Chris, I can't believe we got through the whole episode without making a Beauty and the Beast gag. I don't have one for us now, but listeners can fill in the gaps as to who's who. I think I'm going to come out badly on this exchange, but that's been us for an episode, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.